what that just happened?
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of The Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Gia Scott, and once again, we have another fascinating topic tonight. But before we jump off to that conversation, we do have our usual announcements to make. Now, for tonight's show, just like always, I would love to hear from the listening audience. So please send your questions and comments to me at giascott@exogenynetwork.com. I promise I won't give out your full name or email, and I won't send you any spam, so don't be shy. I know you have something on your mind that you would love to have the answer to. And don't forget, for all of you Facebookers out there, there is a page on Facebook for the Dawn of Shades program where you can easily post comments and ask for future topics. Now, to email me, whether it's for questions for tonight's guest or about something else with the program, send that email off to giascott@exogenynetwork.com. Now, tonight's guest is an author. And her name is Molly Zank. So without any more blabbering from me, Molly, would you be so kind as to introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure, Gia, thanks. Thanks for having me on. It's a fun, exciting experience. Never done radio before. Don't really like my sound of my voice recorded, so it'd be fun
well, you
to
don't
have it.
To do it, I promise.
Okay. But yeah, you a lot of people mispronounce my last name, thanks to my I'll blame my husband's family on that one. But you did get it right. It's Molly Zank, and I am an author and former English teacher. Probably my I call it my day job, my most important job is mom to three little girls. They're 7, 5, and 2 months. So that's a big age gap, but they're sweet, and you'll probably be hearing them in the background because they're a little loud sometimes. As far as books go, I write kind of across genres. I do a lot of historical fiction, romantic comedy, mystery, a little bit of paranormal. So it's sometimes I cross the genres, so it's hard to like just say, oh, it's a romantic comedy, or oh, it's just a straight mystery. So they kind of mix and mingle a little bit. And I have 2 books out right now and a 3rd that's coming out. It was a previously published book that went out of contract, and then another publisher picked it up. So their titles are Chasing Byron, it's a historical fiction, and Unheard Melodies, which is being reprinted this year under a new title called Heart's Affection, and my most recent is a romantic comedy called 90 Cats and No Litter Box in Sight.
90 Cats and No Litter Box in Sight. Oh, you do have to tell us what that one's about.
Oh, well, that one is, it's about it's college-age kids, which is an interesting genre because that's just now becoming really popular is when the kids leave high school and they don't want to read young adult anymore, there's nothing really for them out there. So there's this new genre called new adult that kind of bridges the gap between young adult and adult fiction. So it falls into that category where they're college-age kids are dealing with, you know, being away from home for the first time and relationships and the main character is named Glynis, and she has a series of really horrible dates, trying to find like this, her idea of a perfect guy. And the perfect guy is there the whole time, but she just doesn't really see it or thinks that she's going to do what other people want her to do instead of what she wants to do. So there's the conflict there of, you know, head versus heart, and how much should you listen to your friends and your parents and everyone around you, and how much should you make your own decisions. And the title comes from a line in the first chapter where she's talking about she's had such horrible luck with men that she's just going to stop dating altogether and buy a whole bunch of cats because she'll be a spinster and never marry. And the line is, you can't be a proper spinster without at least 20 cats. I'll have 90.
That's kind of funny. It also kind of reminds me of my own dating days at 40-something, and I went through a streak of, you know, the proverbial dates from hell. And they were really, really bad. And I learned a lot during those really bad, because it was literally, they were strung together within like 2 weeks. I had five that were exceptionally horrible, and they were first dates with different guys. And I learned, you know, a whole lot about how we date, I guess, because dating at 40 something is a lot different than dating at 20 something or as a teenager. It's entirely a different ball game, and you have different issues that come up. Yeah, you know, and so yeah, I can see where
different priorities and everything too.
Well, you're at a very different life stage. I mean, at 20 something, you're looking forward to establishing yourself in a career, having a family, all those kind of things. At 40 something, you've done the bulk of that. You're off on another track altogether. And so you know, and in addition, you're dating your peers, who are also, they've got all these things behind them, or as the saying goes, baggage, you know, and everybody says, oh, I don't want anybody with baggage. Well, you know, we all come with baggage, and some of it's humorous, and some of it's really frightening, and some of it's really scary. I mean, one of the dates in there, I swore up and down, I just had a date with a mass murderer. I mean, he really scared me. I was probably the most scared I'd ever been. I actually went and visited friends for a couple of hours because he even started following me from the restaurant. So, you know, you have entirely different experiences. And I could see where this new adult genre would fit in because, you know, they're not probably as interested in some of the stuff that I might find hitting close to home.
And I think that's also, it took a while for the genre to take off, because when I originally wrote the story, there was no new adult genre, so I was trying to sell it as a young adult, and I was always getting editors would say, oh, it's, these characters are too old for young adults, try the adult market, and then you would try to sub to the adult market, and the adult market editors would say, oh, characters are too young, it has to be YA, and I'm like, no, all the YA editors said that it's not YA, but it's not adult, so it's in between. And new adult was just emerging then. St. Martin's Press started it, or tried to start it up in about 2009, and it didn't catch on then. And it's now just finally really emerging. There's a lot of really good authors in the new adult genre. And what's interesting is most of them seem to be self-published, and the genre took off, so they got all these readers, and they became bestsellers without the, you know, traditional publishing. And now the traditional publishers are buying up all these new adult books and republishing them so that they can reach a wider audience.
Mm-hmm. Now, are your books also available in the ebook format?
They are. They're Chasing Byron, which is my first one, the historical fiction, is print and ebook. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the good stuff that's put out through a mostly historical fiction publisher called Highland Press. They're in the South, they're in Florida, and fun to work with. Kind of a more tamer, sweeter publisher where they do a lot of historical fiction and some young adults, and they started an inspirational line, so they, it's not like erotica's getting
right.
big and popular. It's not that type of publisher. And 90 Cats is an ebook, and that's through a publisher called Utopia, and they have like the wide range of genre of anything. They do well with romance and erotica, and 90 Cats is the new adult, so that's kind of funny when I look at their website and the other books they put out. I'm like, oh, it doesn't really like fit in with their categories, but they loved it and thought it was hysterical, so wanted to publish it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're writing for a new genre, obviously you had it rejected from publishing houses and whatnot. Mm-hmm. How was that your first book that was being rejected?
Yeah. So that was, I guess I was just used to people just going, "Oh, I like this," and offering a contract. I know Jason Byron was. I wrote it specifically for Highland Press because it's a Regency, and they do a lot of Jane Austen-type Regency books. And one of the main characters is Lord Byron, because I'm a former English teacher, really into the Romantic poets. And I wrote it specifically for that market, that publisher, and they accepted it right away, like maybe within a week or two after me submitting it to them. So I'm like, oh, this is easy. I like this. And the same with Unheard Melodies was accepted. Didn't have a great experience with that press, so that's why it's being republished by Highland Press. And then 90 Cats, I did the agent route. I queried agents for, I'd say, 6-7 months straight, just sending out letter after letter, saying this is what it's about, and do you want to see it? And I got a lot of requests because everyone thought it sounded good, but then when, with agents, it comes down to can they sell it? And because it was in that new adult genre, a lot of them didn't think they could sell it. But I did end up getting an agent for it, and he tried for a year and a half to sell it to the different editors and the big publishers, and just couldn't do it. Like, everyone was saying, there's no place for this. We don't know how to market it. And so I cut ties with my agent because I wanted to go at it alone and try to see what I could do. I loved the book. I didn't want to see it just like die a slow death on my computer and have no one read it. And so I started querying direct to editors and publishers myself. And with Utopia, who signed it, I went from querying them, so sending the letter saying, this is my manuscript, do you want to read it? And 11 days later, they offered me a contract. So I always think that's interesting that my agent tried for a year and a half and couldn't sell it, and then waited out the rise of young adult or new adult, and when it was back in my hands, I was able to get a contract in 11 days.
Yeah, that's quite a bit different. A lot of people are aspiring writers. They always dream of being a writer and so forth and so on. And maybe they've even written things, but don't have a clue how to find an audience. What would be your suggestions for them?
Well, first thing is write what you love. Don't write towards trends or... Because vampires may be big now, but they're not going to be big by the time you're ready to query the work, or even by the time it's published, because in traditional publishing, it usually takes a year from the time you sign the contract to when the book comes out. So if you're trying to just follow the trends, like the zombies and the vampires and werewolves and whatever's popular at the moment, then that's not going to work out, because it's going to the waiting is probably the worst part with writing and finding your audience. And just write what you love, write what you know. Because if you write something that you're not comfortable with, if you're just chasing those trends, trying to go after the money, which I think a lot of aspiring writers do, it's not going to make you happy, and I think editors can tell that it's not something that you love, it's just something that you wrote to write, and not that you're really excited and passionate about it. So just be passionate about what you do. I think that goes for any job, not just writing. Just enjoy what you do.
Yeah, I think it does. Because if you don't enjoy it, it's really an unpleasant chore. You know, I keep telling myself that I'm going to learn to enjoy washing dishes, but 50-some years, it's never happened. Dishes remain a chore.
Mm-hmm.
But,
or
yeah, you know.
Loading the dishwasher. It's not as bad as actually washing them.
Yeah, I don't have a dishwasher, so, and I do a lot of cooking. And the family joke is that, you know, I can go in and cook a meal, but every dish in the house will be dirty when I'm done. And that's about what it is I seem to dirty a lot of dishes up more than
the
average.
You have the rule, I cook, but then you clean up, and then you'll never have to do the dishes.
Well,
or your
it
husband
works.
Won't start cooking, huh?
Well, don't scare me that way. Weight loss program. he's famous for his glop. And any food you name glop. Yeah, granted, he can cook. I mean, he's made jams and jellies, and he has cooked good stuff, desserts and dishes and whatnot. But one time when he did cook for me, I don't even remember what was in it, other than there was hominy involved somehow. But it was this thick grayish paste with these brown and white lumps in it, and it really didn't look very good. And I looked at it, and I said, oh, no, I'm not eating that. That's glop. What is it, you know? And it was horrible looking. It really looked disgusting in the pan. And I think he ate it. I don't remember. It's been a number of years ago now. But I still razz him about the glop. And like I said, I don't know what it was, other than it was even uglier than curry. And I could honestly remember I had taken some leftover curry. My first husband was English, and he'd made curry one day, and I'd taken some to work with me the next day. And the vice president of the company happened to walk past the table while I was having my lunch. She actually gagged from looking at it. Because it's this lurid sort of chartreuse color, and then it had the chunks of potato and meat in it, and onion, and it was ugly. It smelled good, it tasted good, but it was truly ugly food. And to her, it was just horrific looking. She literally gagged, which doesn't do much for your lunch to make other people gag.
No.
But, yeah.
Close your eyes when you eat it, and...
Well, I remember walking in and looking at it and thinking, oh, my God, that is so ugly. That's horrible. Because I smelled it when I came in the house. It smelled good. But then when I saw the pot of it, I was like, because it was the ugliest looking dish I could possibly imagine. Then we ate it over rice. And, yeah, it was not attractive looking. I'll have to give that. But it did taste very, very good. Now, when you first started out, okay, a lot of people are wondering, okay, so now I've got my manuscript written, and then they get it accepted by a company. During the editing process, I've known some other authors that had absolute fits about the editing process. They didn't think that their manuscript should be altered in any way. Did you find the editing process painful?
No, I really enjoyed it because it, especially with 90 Cats, it's really nice to have that other pair of eyes, that person that hasn't been there and seen it through 12 or 13 drafts, and they're looking at it fresh and giving you suggestions on just how to improve it or... just make it a little more marketable, usually. And I had an absolutely fabulous editor at Utopia that she does freelance. Her name is Melinda Fulton, and her site is melindaedits.com. And she is just a wonderful, wonderful editor. And she would bring up things that I didn't think about, or she would pick up on character traits and say, oh, this isn't, you need to expand on this, or I ended up almost rewriting the entire second half of the book because there was a plot device in the middle where the main character, Glynis, gets into a love triangle with this seemingly perfect guy named Daniel, and where she kind of pushes to the side the guy that, the nerdy, geeky guy that really likes her and is the main love interest, Corin. And so she gets into a love triangle, and how it was originally written is that she kind of blows Corin off for this, you know, Mr. Perfect guy. And my editor said, you know, that's, she's flip-flopping too much. You know, she's been really interested in Corin this whole time, and then suddenly Daniel shows up and she forgets about Corin. That's not realistic, and she wouldn't do that. It makes her seem cold. And so seeing it through someone else's eyes, I think, is really helpful and useful. And so I redid the ending so that Daniel's not as perfect as he seems, and that she doesn't fall for his little games, and all her family and friends are pushing her towards Daniel because he's who she should want, and who she really wants is geeky, nerdy Corin. So that was something that I didn't even really see until the editor pointed it out, that that very possibly could have been what was turning off the other editors who had looked at it, that they didn't like how the character evolved or handled that situation.
Uh-huh. When you're writing, these stories, you know, the main characters, do you have certain characters that you really like, you know, more than others? Are there characters that you dislike?
I think with 90 Cats, I really like Corin because he's kind of like the anti-hero. He's in romance or romantic comedy or any type of genre dealing with relationships in the mainstream. It's usually like, you know, the main guy is all buff and suave, and I wanted to go against that type with my hero and have him be, you know, the geeky computer science guy who took math and liked, you know, all the geeky sci-fi stuff, and skinny and awkward and, you know, just sensitive and not afraid to show the feelings. And that's not really what the alpha male in that genre is all about usually. And I think that that's kind of silly because, you know, not everyone is, you know, the washboard abs and dashing people, and all types should be represented. So I think as far as heroes go, I think Corin. And then I have the hero in Chasing Byron has a stutter. And so that was a lot of fun to write and a lot of fun to just kind of to work on. And when someone was reading it out loud, I'm like, oh, good luck, that main character has a stutter. Have fun reading that out loud.
Yeah, that would be a little tough to put into an audio book, wouldn't it?
And that was with that, it came across as, when I started writing it, sometimes when you, or at least for me, when I write things, sometimes I don't know where they're going until the story takes me there, or the characters take me there, and it's almost like seeing a movie and writing it down, and you don't know how the movie's going to end, or you don't know how the characters are going to react or not react in certain situations until it's out on the page. And this Walter's stutter in Chasing Byron came about that way, where I didn't intend for the character to stutter, but when I was writing it, that's just what happened. That's what came across when I was typing, was that he stuttered, and I'm like, oh, that's new, that's interesting detail, I'll just go with it. And when I would hear the dialogue, that's what I heard. So that's my process, and that's kind of where for me, it's like transcribing what I see and hear instead of just forcing the characters to do what we want them to. I let them tell their own stories.
Yeah, and you know, I've heard it put different ways. Some people say it's like they dream the story and then they write it down, and or see a movie and write it down, or watch it, you know, happening. And you know, it's interesting to hear how people put the creative process, because that's essentially what you're doing. You know, when you're watching this movie in your head or dreaming it or whatever, it's your creative process coming out. Now, in the world of paranormal novels, that seems to be a genre that is somewhat, I guess ambiguous is the only way I could put it, because a lot of book selling companies, like if you go onto Amazon and they don't have a genre listed as paranormal romance or paranormal novels. It just doesn't exist. And yet I know a number of people that write paranormal romance. Paranormal romances seem to be especially popular. Where you use a bit of the paranormal in yours, how do you think that affects their marketability?
I think most publishers and a lot of readers, they do like that little bit of paranormal, even if it's not the main focus of the plot. They like that little bit of unknown or that little bit of mystery in it. And I know with young adult, it seems like when they say paranormal, young adult paranormal, it's usually like werewolves or vampires or some sort of creature involved. But I think more with the adult side of things, it's usually aliens or psychics or ghosts or something a little more not so tangible, like, oh, there's a vampire. It's more metaphysical than the paranormal creatures. But yeah, it's a very wide and broad genre, hard to define.
You're still there, Molly?
Yeah, I think my Wi-Fi might be blinking, but...
Okay.
Is it in trouble?
I'm not sure which one of us was. I sort of blanked out. I wasn't sure what was going on. But we seem to be back on base again, so we're doing okay. So you were saying about the paranormal. Yeah, the last word I heard was, you know, young adult, it was werewolves and vampires, and then in the adult genre... It was.
It's more, I think, more metaphysical based in the adult genre. There's more to do with psychics and ghosts and aliens, and so it's a little more mental instead of just very obvious. Like with the young adult, there's vampires, there's werewolves, there's fairies and elves are the new thing too in young adult. So it's more creature based is what I call it. I call it creature paranormal, and adult is usually more, I think, a little more interesting, because I know when I think paranormal, I think about ghosts and psychic abilities, and that's always been more interesting to me than any idea of are vampires real, or is there a fairy princess out there, or whatever people are trying to cash in on at the moment in the young adult genre.
Yeah, I have to admit the vampire thing, you know, this isn't the first time it's been sort of in the forefront of everybody's mind. But you know, it kind of gets old. You know,
there's only so much you can do with it. I mean, there's very few original ideas that you can come up with for vampires or werewolves or anymore, I think. So that's tough to stand out. If people are writing about vampires or werewolves, that's really, really tough to stand out. And that some agents and some publishers are saying no vampires nor werewolves. They don't want to see it anymore because there's nothing new.
Well, and I can kind of see that too, that the whole werewolf and vampire thing, for one thing, it's sort of stretching believability. I mean, the ability to physically transform into another creature. Yeah, it's, you know, the shape-shifting stuff gets a little weird. You know, many people have had an experience where with a ghost or know somebody that has. You know, and other types of paranormal, you know, the psychic thing and whatnot. It's much more believable to adults, I guess, is what the deal is. You know, we have a harder time with shape-shifting than we do with seeing a ghost. So it just sort of blends in with the, you know, the same kind of reality that dishes and bills come in. It's possible, you know.
Yeah.
It's possible. So, yeah, I could see where adults would be less interested in, as you call it, the creature paranormal than they would with the other types of paranormal. And, you know, I agree. It's much more interesting. Maybe that's why adults do have paranormal. It doesn't involve a creature. So are you working on another book now?
I am working. I kind of sometimes go in spurts. Well, I'll work a lot pretty quickly, and then I'll take a break, and then I'll start, you know, writing again. And I'm working on a short Regency novel for my publisher, Highland Press. They're putting out an anthology, so they asked me to write something. So I'm slowly working on that. I was going really quickly through it last week, and then life gets in the way, and then I stop for a bit, and then I start again. So,
well, I imagine with a young baby as well as two young daughters, your life is quite busy.
Yeah, a couple hours a day while the older girls are in school, and that's usually when I take the time to write, catch up on TV, you know, do mundane things like that, catch up on TV, and work on whatever manuscript I have in my head at the moment. But right now it's a retelling of Pride and Prejudice through the elder sister Jane's perspective. So that's what I'm going to hopefully have included in the anthology, Regency anthology. And I'm also working on a paranormal that's based on my experiences living in St. Augustine when I went to college in St. Augustine. And it's a really very spiritual town because of all the history. And it's just kind of an insane place to live if you have any sensitivity to the other side. And the college I went to was haunted, which made it very interesting 4 years. And so it's based on going to a haunted college.
Uh-huh. Okay. That would be an interesting experience. I had the misfortune, you might say, to live in a haunted house years and years ago. And it was definitely interesting. Even though we lived there for years, I don't think I could possibly drag up enough experiences to write an entire book about it. Although at some point I could see where some of them, I think the creepiest one was, I was a teenager, and late one night I was doing dishes and everybody else was upstairs asleep. And then I felt someone looking at me as I was standing at the kitchen sink. And I turned around and I saw a man and a black dog standing there on the other side of the kitchen. Now, why I put my hands behind my back as I sidled along in front of the stove and refrigerator to get to the door and then run like the dickens upstairs, I don't know, but I did. And the creepy thing was, is they both watched me as I did. They didn't move towards me or anything. They just stood there. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of dressed in timeless clothing. So, you know, it wasn't even like they came from a specific era. It was like a black Labrador, and the man was wearing like jeans and a plaid flannel shirt. Nothing distinguishing about him. No idea who they were. Now he looked old to me, you know, as a teenager, so he was probably in his 30s. But you know, it terrified me. I mean, we'd never seen people in there. It was usually a case of hearing footsteps and, The refrigerator burst into flames once. You'd see these shimmery basketball-sized balls going upstairs or moving through the through the other rooms or whatever. And it was creepy and scary and what, and pots and pans flying around the kitchen. That happened a few times. So, you know, it was mostly like poltergeist type activity mm-hmm. going on. So to see somebody, you know, I don't know who they were. Nobody else ever saw people or a dog. What it was about, I don't know, but you know, even now thinking about it, the hair standing up on the back of my neck. It's like I want to turn around and look, you know.
Yeah. Following you. And it's
so, yeah. Ghosts and whatnot do have the ability to really scare people. Not sure why, but they definitely do.
I think some of my most interesting experiences in St. Augustine were, the dorms were, I think it's probably one of the only colleges that still do girls in one dorm, guys in another, and there's no interdorm visitation. You can't be in there if you're not in your designated area. And so it's like weird things like be taking a shower and then see like a shadow go across the bathroom, like you could see it through the shower curtain, that there was like this shadow just walking through the bathroom, and things would move. And I remember one time going to the, it was an old hotel. The college used to be an old hotel at the turn of the century. It was a real big resort area in the early 1900s and late 1800s. And so there was an elevator. And in modern times, to get in the elevator, you would have to put your key in and turn the key. And the elevator would come, you'd get in, and you'd, you know, push your floor number and go up. And I remember walking towards the elevator. I got my key out. I was going to put my key in. And the door opened, and there was no one there. So I went, okay, that's weird. And I stepped into the elevator. Door closed, and it automatically took me to the third floor without me pressing any buttons.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my floor, so whoever was doing that knew where I lived. So I'm like, oh, thanks. You got the right floor. And then by it. Without pushing any buttons. And there's also St. Augustine is an interesting town.
Yeah, I've never been to St. Augustine. Maybe one of these days I'll have to make a trip there, because I have heard from a number of people that it's an interesting place to visit.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you're going through life, you know, the things that we have that become our memories and help shape who we are in the future, these things are also the things that appear in your novels and influence what you write, aren't they?
They are. I think that's part of the write what you know kind of advice that a lot of people give, is that, you know, yes, it's nice to create some like crazy off the wall ideas and stories, but I think it's easier if you're basing them a bit on what you already know, what you've already experienced, because then they're more real to you, and you're able to draw on how you felt and what happened to you, instead of just trying to think, okay, what would this character do? How would this resolve itself? And I know with 90 Cats, when I was writing about a lot of situational comedy in that, where almost like a TV show where it's your bad date, and I would read the papers for like really crazy news stories and incorporate that in, because a lot of people are like, oh, where did you get your ideas? And I'm like, well, I saw this one story years and years and years ago about this monkey that these ladies found this little monkey wandering the streets and brought it home, and he attacked them with a steak knife and only calmed down when they threw him a bag of marshmallows. And so he ripped open the bag of marshmallows with his knife and stuffed his face with all these marshmallows and fell asleep, and then that's how the ladies escaped. And I incorporated that in a way into 90 Cats, where the main character, Clunas, gets mugged by a monkey with a switchblade and held hostage in a porta potty. So I kind of, when I read the monkey story, I'm like, I have to use this at some point. I'm cutting it out of the paper. I'm going to save it. It needs to be in a story somewhere. And then I finally got to use the, that idea for a manuscript later on. I think it must have been a good 10 years from the time I read the monkey hostage situation story to when I wrote my first draft of 90 Cats, that I'm like, okay, now I can use the monkey story finally. Finally time.
Yeah, I mean, that monkey story, I mean, it is. It's one of those really crazy things. It's too weird to be made up. You know, fact is stranger mm-hmm. than fiction, and that's often true. You know, I think about a lot of people who had lifetimes of experience that if you wrote a character that had those experiences, you would be accused of being too creative with their lives, that it's impossible. And, you know, I could see where these kinds of stories, though, would work well for inspiring, you know, a particular section in a novel.
I think that's maybe why I'm a bit of a news junkie, too, because I'm always watching headline news or CNN or local news, just trying to see, okay, what's going on, what's happening now, what can I use for later, what can inspire me.
Mm-hmm.
For later on.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm fond of the weird news category, or odd news, I forget which mm-hmm. they call it, because that's where the really goofy stories are, is usually in that category online, because I probably get most of my news from online sources. And so this weird news category, you know, it's got the strange things, you know, a woman stuck on a toilet for 7 years and, you know, that kind of stuff. And
that's fun.
The yeah.
fun stuff to read.
You know, the stuff that makes you go, why? You kind of like, you know, the day you discover your teenage daughter has stuck her head through a balcony railing and is now stuck. Mm-hmm. It's like, why did you do this? You know, what was going through your head? And how am I going to get you out of there? Yeah. I actually did have my teenage daughter do once. You know, it's like, what were you thinking?
Probably wasn't. Or was it a dater? Or why did she think, that's a good idea?
I never did get a straight answer out of her. I guess she just thought it would be amusing. It was until she started having a panic attack because she was stuck, and then she threw up. And, oh, you know, it was really one of those things in your life you kind of go, why? You know, what were you thinking? Yeah, I don't know if she remembers it or not, but I definitely do. So, yeah, it was one of those moments when, you know, the duh thing, yeah, as the saying goes. And that's the same kind of stuff that you find in those weird news categories. Like the monkey, I mean, who would have thought? You know, it often involves an animal because animals are prone to do things we consider weird for whatever reason. Maybe, you know, an animal rescues somebody or, you know, whatever. But there's always something interesting in the weird news category. In fact, I'm surprised. I didn't even check the weird news category today. And usually it's something that just I find absolutely mind-boggling. It kind of takes and puts your own life in perspective often because it's just so out there. Now, granted, a lot of times it's out there, yeah, so far that you can't quite figure out how they got there, but
it makes you happy it's not you that has that story written about them.
Yeah, you know, being in the news was never something I wanted to do, I guess. You know, it's just people don't get in the news usually for good things, and that's the strange thing about news, is that it is so far out there.
Well, every once in a while you see, like, the stories about heroes or the good news type of thing, but it seems like they just love, mainstream media loves to focus on the bad and scare tactics. And I mean, even something simple like the weather report. I'm in Colorado, and we're still getting snow, even though tomorrow's May 1st and planning to get 6 inches of snow. And the weather report is all, they try to scare you. And I think just something simple like, ooh, it's going to snow, watch out for the roads. And the same with the news, where they always focus on the negative, and they don't focus on the positive or the fun, light, funny stuff that would make people feel a little better about the world in general.
Right, and it's like to horrify us and scare us and gross us out. You know, shock. Shock seems to be what they are especially fond of. I know the other day one of the big news things, because sometimes the things that make the news kind of make you go, why? Fixation on the activities of various celebrities. The other day it was a blogger in Texas had written some nasty comment about a cheerleader for some sports team being too heavy. And
I saw that too.
Fuss about that. Yeah, and I'm like, why is this such a big deal? You know, really? Now, if she'd written somebody was too skinny, they probably wouldn't have cared. But, yeah, you know, that
was... Even with the celebrities, they're like, Lindsay Lohan ate at this restaurant, and so Kim Kardashian is wearing this today. And it's like, I don't really care what they're wearing or eating. And it's... Some celebrity news is interesting, but then most of it's just kind of mundane, boring stuff that wouldn't matter if they weren't celebrities. No one follows us around trying to figure out what we're going to eat.
And if somebody actually did follow me around, they would have a very, very boring time. Going to the grocery store. Now we're going to the post office. Ooh, let's take a side trip to the library. Yeah.
So I think reality TV is not really reality. It's got to be scripted to some extent to make it interesting.
Well, it has to be. I mean, they have to be condensing like an entire week into an hour.
No, get down. Get down.
Okay, we're back again.
Okay.
Yeah, kind of blinked out there for a second. Anyhow, yeah, I think where they condense these reality shows down and eliminate all the boring stuff, it gives people an unrealistic expectation of what a celebrity's life is like.
And it probably makes them think, oh, you know, they follow that teen mom around, so maybe if I get pregnant at 15, I can have my own reality show, and the Jersey Shore, all those ones where it's just people being silly or stupid and not who you want to glorify, I think.
No. And they do have somewhat unrealistic perspectives. And the whole thing with these people that are famous for merely being famous, and the fixation that people have on what they wear, how they do their hair, what kind of makeup they buy, what color their fingernails are, color their socks are. I mean, come on. You know, it really, I guess, I'm not a fashion slave myself, never was. You know, my idea of dressing up typically was, you know, like a newer pair of jeans and a newer t-shirt. Yeah, I mean, I've never been all that much on dressing up. I mean, I could, but did I enjoy it? No, I was most comfortable in a pair of jeans and boots, you know. And I think that's true for many people. But other people want to be more, they feel like they're missing out somehow. And maybe they haven't discovered the sheer joy of escaping into a novel and being someone else for a while. Do you enjoy reading other people's works?
I do. I like that escapism, especially with the small children at home. There's special needs as well, so it's a lot of stress and a lot of work. And just being their mom is more than a full-time job. And so it's nice to just relax and read. But the problem I sometimes find when I read other people's work is that I can't quite turn off that English teacher writer part of my brain. So I'll be like, oh, this isn't very well written. Why is this so popular? And it's, and a lot of times too, especially since I started writing for publication instead of just writing for myself, is that you start to question, like, oh, how did this get published? And this is really bad. Why did this big publisher pick this up? And you kind of almost have a lot of questions while you're reading someone else's book. At least for me, it's sometimes hard to disconnect completely and just escape and read. And there's been some book series that I've been able to just completely lose myself in the books. But it's kind of harder since I started writing for publication mm-hmm. to really just completely disconnect and read for fun. And it's probably partially English teacher too, where I'm always checking the grammar and if there's plot holes or anything like that.
Yeah, until recently I hadn't realized that I'd almost completely eliminated fiction from my reading. I'd read so many books for the program, and the vast majority, up until we were doing this series, have been nonfiction books. So you read those books, and then, you know, my own interests, reading nonfiction books relating to those, a lot, oftentimes they're, you know, really exciting how-to books. And slowly over time, all of a sudden I realized I haven't read a fiction book in ages and ages. So I've, you know, over the last year or so, I've tried to remedy that and read more fiction. And I found some authors I really, really enjoy, and some, you know, I have to admit that I've looked at and said, why? I mean, why would anybody write it, let alone publish it? So yeah, you know, I can be kind of critical sometimes. I guess because of the fact that I spent so much time in English class actually paying attention, I guess, you know, makes it where, you know, when you see grammatical errors or misspelled words and you're wondering, you know, how did this get past editing? It should have been caught. I mean, should have been caught. But that's just, you know, I guess. And then I do review books for a number of people, and I have had proof copies. And a proof copy, for people that aren't aware, is an uncorrected version. It's not the final retail version.
And they usually say on the book, this is an uncorrected proof, so you're not...
Exactly. And big letters.
You're not like, ooh, these are...
Sale, yeah.
That editor was horrible there. Why?
You
know.
Yeah.
Well, it's not in their final
sheet. You do sometimes find, you know, horrible mistakes. A page is repeated twice. Or pages will be out of order. Or sentences or paragraphs will be repeated. You know, and it's usually a case of... It looks like when somebody was cutting and pasting, they just kind of went overboard there. Hit it twice. And, yeah, it's, you know, the uncorrected proof is not the one you actually read. Now, we are coming up on a break. But before we go to break, Molly, you want to tell them where they can find your books?
Well, if you're interested in reading excerpts and the like a summary of them, you could go to my website, which is Molly, M-O-L-L-Y, Zenk, V-E-N-K, at, or sorry, dot webs, W-E-B-S, dot com. And then there's buy links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I think also fiction-wise, Kobu, pretty much any e-reader site should have them, or you could go to your local bookstore and ask them to order it for you if you want a print copy.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, folks, it is time for us to take a break. So hang on to your keyboard. Don't move a muscle. We will be back with more conversation with Molly Zenk right after this short break.
TM Pacific on the Galactic Connection, keeping you connected 1 hour at a time. For more information, please visit thegalacticconnection.com.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and along with Joe Montaldo, we co-host a new show called News on the Flip Side. You can catch us every Saturday night, 8 p.m. Central, where we will be discussing current events and topics going on in the world today. We have opinions on everything. There's no topic that we won't discuss, and we'll go places that other shows wouldn't dare. False history gets made all day, every day. The truth of the new is never on the news, but you can catch it here, News on the Flip Side, only on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
I have a place where dreams are born, and time is never planned. It's not on any chart, you must find it with your heart. Never,
Neverland. Hello, everyone. I'm psychic medium Christopher George, and along with my co-host, Victor the Voice Firm, and we are Second Sight NYC. Victor, who do we have on as a guest this week?
Chris, our guest this week is Dr. Leslie Phillips. She's into meditation, healing, and intuitive communication, and she's author of the book, The Midas Dream, a magical journey involving a golden acorn and a journey that we can all take into the mysterious.
Victor, the last time I took a magical journey, I was smoking some peyote and I saw a bunch of fairies.
You must have been in the West Village, Chris.
Ba-dum-bum.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to Dawn of Shades. I'm your host, Dan Scott. Tonight, we are talking with Molly Zenk. Now, don't forget, you can send your questions into my email, gscott@exogenynetwork.com. And before we get started, Molly, would you want to tell everybody where to find your website again?
Sure. It's my first and last name, Molly Zenk, M-O-L-L-Y-Z-E-N-K, .webs, W-E-B-S, .com. And there you can find reviews and summaries and excerpts and cover art and a little biography and links to where to get everything. One of mine, Chasing Byron, was sold to a publisher in Brazil, so it has international readers now, which is kind of interesting, just seeing it translated into Portuguese and the new international cover. I think they retitled it because I guess Chasing Byron doesn't translate very well to Portuguese. It's called oh, I don't even remember now, something about the Lord, because it's Lord Byron, the bad Lord, or I don't even remember what it translates into in Portuguese, but it's really, if you Google Translate, the biography on the Portuguese website is kind of amusing.
Google Translate can be amusing in itself. And if you really, really want to, you have some time to kill and you want to really amuse yourself, take a passage from anything, something you write, whatever, and translate it into the simplified Chinese and then back out. Just try translating it in different languages and then back into English and see how the distortions happen. And it's no wonder we have trouble understanding other cultures sometimes, because things don't always translate the way we think they would.
Mm-hmm.
And translating is truly an art that's not going to be replaced with a computer anytime soon, because it does get a little weird. Yeah, I did that one day just out of curiosity, and I was really kind of amazed at the really horrible way that things could be changed around, where it didn't mean anything remotely resembling the original passage. So yeah, that's a fun way to kill some time, is to translate things back and forth into another language using one of the automated translators.
Now, it might be, if you've noticed, like a lot of the foreign books too, they always come out with like new translations, and I wondered, you know, why are they retranslating this? There's already two or three different versions of it, but I think, like you said, there's just so many nuances and so many different ways you could say something from one language to the next, and they try to get it as close as the original meaning.
Yeah, and a lot of times it's the it's not the literal meaning of the words is not the same as the way we understand the entire context to be. And that it adds confusion for anybody who has just kind of a minimal grasp of another language. They know how difficult it is to communicate with someone in that language. And the same thing is true when somebody who has just a very rudimentary understanding of English tries to tell you something in English. It can get confusing, and sometimes they say things that are just really wrong sounding to us. We tend to give them, you know, the benefit of the doubt, even when they say something that, you know, you would never say in normal English to someone. But the translation comes across so badly that
I hear English is one of the hardest languages to learn too, and that makes sense because it's just such a mix of so many different languages.
Yeah, we're definitely kind of borrowing language.
Hard to master it for a lot of people.
Yeah,
even native speakers have trouble.
Yeah, and native speakers, you know, I was surprised to find out the rather limited number of words that the average native speaker is actually going to use in their day-to-day life. We have very obscure words I've never, because I considered myself to be, you know, reasonably well-educated in vocabulary, and occasionally I still run across a word, I'm like, what does that mean? I've never seen that word before. Well, come to find out, it's a word that's just not used very much. A lot of times, too, we have lingo that's attached to a specific area of interest, be it your job or a hobby or whatever, that it maybe has a different meaning than mainstream English. Maybe it is a word that is never used anyplace else but in that particular little niche, you might say. So that's something interesting.
And that is real interesting, and it reminds me of when I went to Europe when I was a teenager, and we got to stay with a German host family, and my German's not as good as it used to be, but like living in it, you really pick it up quickly. And but just like what a word means to us means something different to them, or they don't like they asked me one time, well, what do you have for breakfast? And I'm like, oh, bacon, eggs, hash browns. And they're like, hash browns? Thinking I meant hash as in the drug. And I'm like, no, not that kind of hash. No, potatoes. And they're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. And then the mom just looked like she was going to have a heart attack when she thought we ate hash for breakfast.
Well, you know, even, you know, this is a common southern and southwestern breakfast, biscuits and gravy. Now, if you're from the UK and somebody's having biscuits and gravy, it would be like us saying, I'm having cookies with gravy. You know, it's just not the same thing. So, you know, I guess Britain doesn't have the equivalent of the American biscuit. This is something that's very American. And, you know, even things that are really mundane to Americans, like cornbread, okay? Cornbread is something that almost everybody in America has eaten at least once. Mm-hmm. In many families, it accompanies many meals. In our family, it was served with chili, and it was served with potato soup. Those were two times when you could reasonably expect that if you were having one, you'd have the other. And you know, one time I did this just sort of to prove a point in a chat room. This is a number of years ago, that people will talk about anything. And you know, I was going on about the cornbread conspiracy, and you know that it made a big to do out of whether or not you should adulterate cornbread with extras such as cheese or corn or chilies or whatever. And someone from Britain was in the room, and they said, oh, there's only one cornbread factory in all of the UK. And I just kind of stopped. I couldn't even imagine a cornbread factory.
A factory that only makes cornbread.
I cannot imagine. I'm sure there was some misunderstanding there,
mm-hmm.
because as far as I know, nobody even makes cornbread there. But yeah, I just can't imagine if it's only recently that you see bakeries making cornbread
mm-hmm.
in the United States. It was always something that was done at home because it was so easy to make, and every good housewife, I guess, knew how to make it.
Well, I would think too that, you know, the mixes are so common, and you could just go to the grocery store bakery and pick up a loaf if you don't want to make it yourself. So that's kind of interesting that if it was translated correctly, like he understood what you were saying, that they would have a whole factory that only makes cornbread, and that, oh, that's kind of,
yeah,
I'm imagining like the people working there and, you know, who's in charge of mixing, and then they have to package it, or how that would be I don't know how interesting of a job that would be, day in, day out, only baking cornbread.
Well, I suppose it's no worse than making widgets and putting them into packets. I mean,
that's true.
No matter what you're doing. Although I have to admit, okay, you know, some of the things that I've done in the past, I remember being a waitress. Now, most people, they never think about their waitress. I happen to really despise being with people who want to treat a waitress badly, because I can remember being one, you know, when I was young, too.
Mm-hmm.
But being a waitress was probably one of the most interesting jobs you could possibly have. You dealt with a wide variety of people. I happened to work near an interstate, and so you got travelers of all kinds, as well as locals. So you would meet sometimes famous people, sometimes, you know, people that were going to become famous for not so good reasons. But you did meet all kinds of people, and there was never, ever a boring day. I couldn't imagine a boring day, simply because the people were so strange. And if you work graveyard, it got even weirder.
I've heard that it's like the overnight shift, or like 2 in the morning. It's always interesting to see who shows up at a restaurant or who shows up at a grocery store. or at a convenience store at 2 in the morning.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. It's like I happen to be at my most creative in the middle of the night. Okay? It doesn't matter if I'm doing artwork, crafts, writing, whatever I'm doing. The middle of the night is when I tend to do it. I'm a morning person normally, so I don't know why this middle of the night creativity bug bites me. As well as when I'm conversing with friends, you usually have your best conversations in the middle of the night. So then you would have these wonderful conversations over coffee or whatever, and then the next morning you got to get up early and be a human being. And I was lamenting this one time with a coworker, and I said, why can't we do this stuff at a decent hour and then, you know, not be tired the next day? And he was very serious and says, no, it's because when everybody else goes to sleep, their thoughts are no longer inhibiting yours, so you can become creative. I thought, well, okay, you know, I don't know, but it's the best reason I've ever heard for why people tend to be more creative in the middle of the night, why they have the most interesting conversations, et cetera, et cetera. Because it doesn't necessarily have to do with use of drugs or alcohol, which is what most people assume, you know, you're doing in the middle of the night is something illegal. No, you know, it was very often nothing stronger than a cup of coffee with cream and sugar. And, you know, you'd be sitting around talking and you'd get these really intense conversations. But they never happen at 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Has to be midnight or 2 in the morning. And
yeah.
I find that I'm probably the most creative. Like, I'll wake up at between 2 and 3 in the morning with all sorts of ideas running through my head. And I'm like, no, not right now. I need to sleep. And why can't I think like this at 6 in the morning when I wake up, or noon when everyone's at school? It just, you know, I started keeping like a little notebook next to the bed to jot ideas down if they were really, really insistent and wouldn't go away, that I could jot them down and try to go back to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Although for me, by the time I got up, got my glasses, found the pen and paper again.
Mm-hmm. They're gone. Huh?
Well, you know, I'm up now. Once I'm up, yeah. I'm like up. I'm going to be up for an hour or two. And I'll admit it. Sometimes I go to bed early and then I get up in the middle of the night and then I'm creative anyhow. But, you know, especially when you have young kids still, it doesn't matter if it's the weekend and you theoretically don't have to go to work. You still have to be mom, you know, early in the morning. And, you know, so this middle of the night creativity was something that really did have me question, why?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have to do this in the middle of the night? Why can't we do this at a normal, civilized hour? Yeah.
We'd make it easier, but I guess that's not how creativity wants to work.
I guess not. You know, maybe I'm most creative when I'm half asleep. Maybe you have to be tired so that part of your inhibiting part of the brain turns off. Who knows? But children can be creative at 6 a.m. Just try letting a kid get up before mom does. Feel creative.
Yeah, well, lucky for my kids, 6 a.m. is when I get up, and I just don't like when they get up at 3 in the morning and don't go back to bed. And then I'm like, oh, it's going to be such a long day.
Yeah. And with the age span that you've got, I can see where if one doesn't, the other one might. So I remember mine were 8 years apart, and I can remember quite interesting times. Not only are you bouncing from boys to Barney, but you've got, you know, one going to school early in the morning and one have to wake up in the middle of the night to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So it does keep you kind of on the jump. Is the overall experience of being a mom and juggling all this, do you think that's going to feature in a future novel?
Possibly. I've thought of it. But then I wonder, you know, am I too close to the situation? Do I really want to write about it? Both my older daughters have autism, and that's kind of like a hot topic now anyways in the news and in nonfiction. And fiction, it's starting to make its way into fiction books now that characters are have autism or there's someone in their life that has autism. I think it's one of those, you don't see it in books very often, so people are wanting more of that, like the special needs or special ed angle to books. And I've thought of writing about it because it's something I know and something I'm familiar with and have that firsthand experience. So it's not like I'm just trying to read it out of a book and create a character based on a book, you know, what I'm reading from a book instead of what I live every day. And I have incorporated autism into a manuscript that I'm shopping to agents now, where one of the characters has Asperger's, which is high-functioning autism that usually shows up more in, like, social awkwardness and not being able to read social signals or not know how to relate to people. So
yeah, I actually only experience dealing with autism was I had a coworker with Asperger's syndrome, and it was interesting because first I didn't realize what was wrong. I just knew that he didn't respond appropriately. And, you know, it took a while to figure out, okay, what's wrong and how do I deal with this? Because it was difficult at first. When you're expecting someone to behave in a certain way and they don't, you're kind of like, why? And, yeah, I could see where that would be something that's, first of all,
so with the manuscript that's currently out with agents, the character with Asperger's is in high school, so she's trying to fit in the situation where everything is based on appearance and doing, you know, what the crowd is doing. And when she's having trouble with social situations, that makes trying to be popular that much more difficult.
I could see where that would be true. Because it really, to me, you know, as someone who dealt with somebody like that at work every day, it was, the biggest problem was his complete inability to read social behavior and interpret it and respond appropriately.
Yeah, that, with Asperger's, that's the, like, they can be absolutely brilliant at what they do. They usually lean more towards, like, the sciences and math and something very analytical and able to be in their own minds and think a lot. But just the social side of the social piece is what's missing. And they have such a hard time relating. And so that I thought that was an interesting idea of how would a teenager with Asperger's try to fit in. Or would they just say, okay, this is who I am and deal with it? Or, you know, are they going to cave into peer pressure and say, all right, you know, I don't want to be different anymore. I want to be like everyone else.
Yeah. That would be an interesting book, I have to admit. You know, granted, I had very limited experience with the Asperger's, but, you know, just trying to imagine a teenager dealing with those issues, it would be difficult. And, you know, as a parent and now a grandparent, even from that perspective of watching someone deal with it, it would be very, very hard to try and figure out how to help appropriately.
And with my girls, they're kind of what's considered classic autism, where their speech and social skills are the most affected. So, like, it's tough trying to explain that to small kids, too. Like, if we go to the playground and kids want to play with them, but they don't answer back to the kids, or they act like the kid didn't say anything to them. And so then that's really difficult to explain to this child who wants to play with my kids, oh, you know, they can hear you, but they're just not going to answer, or they don't talk as much as they should, and they probably will want to play with you, but they're not going to talk to you, because that's, I think, the hardest part is the communication side. And they get frustrated because they can't communicate everything that they want to. And for me, sometimes it's difficult to see what I call neurotypical kids, you know, just general or typically developing kid that can talk and, you know, they interact and they play. And it's, for me, it can be hard to see this is where they should be. You know, they should be going to ballet. They should be going to gymnastics. They should be in normal classrooms, but they're not. And they'll get there someday, but they're not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I try to do, try to stay positive and say they'll get there someday. And
yeah.
I think that's probably why I won't write anything about a mother dealing with autism, because it's too every day for me, and it's too close to home.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that. Now, as a parent of autistic kids, you know, when did they first start showing signs of autism?
I remember my oldest, Emmy, who you could probably hear in the background, she's trying to make cookies by herself, which is interesting. But I got mad when I tried to move the ingredients. But I noticed what's interesting is they both developed absolutely perfectly normal. They were advanced up until, both of them started talking at 6 months old. And they're doing sentences at 7 months old. So I'm like, oh, they're gifted. We're going to, you know, pick out a special school, and because they're so advanced. And then at 15 months, I noticed that Emmy, her language, it's like it went away, like she was drawing into herself, and what she couldn't express herself anymore, or as well as she used to. And it was very isolating for her, because she couldn't communicate anymore and she couldn't get her point across anymore. And that's when I first noticed with her that she regressed at 15 months. But I let people talk me out of getting her tested till she was 3. And so I always kind of beat myself up about that a bit, because I'm like, I knew and I saw it. And as a mother, I knew something was not right. But she was my first. So you don't know what's going on, or really you're learning how to be a parent at that point still too. And so I just said, okay, I'm just being paranoid, or I just watched this interview where someone had an autistic child, so that's why I'm thinking about this. And so I let everyone talk me out of getting her tested till she was 3. So we probably missed some good early intervention opportunity with her. And then with our second daughter, when we noticed a lot earlier, because we knew the signs to look for. And so we got her intervention a lot earlier, at about 2.
Mm-hmm.
And then our youngest, who's a baby, she is developmentally normal right now, and we're just going to keep monitoring her. Every 6 months, she's going to get evaluated to see if she's still developing normally and not regressing. So that was a big fear when I was pregnant, was, are we going to have 3 special needs kids instead of 2?
Uh-huh.
But, and then we just had to put that fear out of my mind and say, they're wonderful, fun kids that really make me appreciate everything they do, because I don't take it for granted. You know, when they talk and say stuff to me, it's like a big party time, because they don't talk all that much, or at where they should be at this level. So it makes me appreciate everything they do a lot more than if they were neurotypical children.
Yeah, you know, I didn't have experience with autism. With me, it was ADD and ADHD. And for me, because of the fact that, you know, when my kids were diagnosed, they also diagnosed me as ADD. There didn't seem to be any real problem. The only people that seemed to have trouble with this was the school. you know, we developed coping mechanisms, and I actually only spent 1 year continually fighting with the school when they wanted my son medicated. And I didn't feel that the medication was appropriate in his case, because even though he was hyperactive, he could concentrate if you let him, I guess was the way I saw it. So we developed alternative methods of coping, and everything worked out fine in the long run. But, you know, it does teach you to sort of multi-track and to plan ahead for the bad times of day, I guess you might say. Because I knew that, like with my son's case, that the afternoons were going to be like okay, mornings not so okay, and evenings definitely not okay. And so you planned your activities where you kept it to a dull roar. And I knew what time of day we were going to try and do something in public and when we weren't. In addition, he had to have some medication that made it worse for his asthma. And so we did have to learn how to adapt around the medication, because with a very young child with asthma, you have to, they can't use an inhaler. So you have to plan ahead for the attacks, which is interesting, because they had to take it 30 minutes before an attack. So you learned what things were going to cause it. In his case, it was that year we happened to live in Minnesota where he was taking the medication. And so if you were going to be outside and it was cold and it was going to be below 30 degrees or so, I knew he was going to have an attack. So he had to have it 30 minutes before we left. And then if he was going to be outside again later in the day, he had to have it 30 minutes before we did that. And he couldn't sit still or behave in a socially acceptable manner, even for a three-year-old. So there was no sense in trying to make it. Other people, however, are not as understanding. When they see your kid doing strange things, in his case, it would be spinning and around in circles or weaving and that kind of behavior, random movements, that they would stare. And sometimes be downright rude. And he couldn't help it. The medication is what made him act like that. When he wasn't taking it, he wasn't doing those things at least. So I can imagine that autism can really influence your life in a number of different ways besides just interacting with your kids themselves.
Yeah, we had a lot of the similar experiences to what you're describing, where going out in public and certain things will set off sensory issues, like public bathrooms are noisy and the pipes are noisy and the smell is bad. So our oldest daughter is very sensitive to smells and sounds, and so can't go near a public restroom, or like a hand dryer in the public restroom is off limits, and vacuum cleaners and just any small motor noise seems to be will set her off and cause this big panic freak out. And so we spent a lot of years avoiding anything that had a hand dryer or any vacuum cleaner. We still to this day can't own a vacuum cleaner because she's so afraid of the vacuum. So it's
it's interesting you talk about that, because my daughter, who is, you know, a mom herself now, when she was little had what the doctors termed hypersensitive hearing. And they actually wanted to cause hearing damage to reduce it, because she would have panic attacks over these loud noises. No fireworks, no revving engines near her, no air compressors, anything like that. Her hands would go over her ears, and she'd have the screaming heebie-jeebies and blind run. He was like, you got to catch her and get her away from the noise, because she would run out in front of cars, whatever, just to get away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, today they'd probably diagnose that as sensory processing disorder.
You know, when they wanted to do that, I said, you know, she could be a teenager someday. We'll let her keep the hearing. I'll just deal with the noise. Mm-hmm.
And you plan your life, like you said, you plan your life around it, and you say, okay,
yeah,
we can't
go
here because it's noisy.
We didn't go to the 4th of July displays. We watched them from a couple blocks away, where the noise she wasn't real comfortable, but it wasn't terrifying her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we would stay, because she liked to watch it. She just couldn't tolerate the noise. And, you know, now she's, you know, perfectly normal about noises. Maybe her house is a little quieter than most, but not a lot. You know, it's just she didn't do well with noises when she was little. She did eventually get where she actually likes to work on engines and cars, even though when the motor's revving right there. So, you know, most of it went away over time. But, yeah, it is interesting that you talk about that noise thing, because I can remember that very, very well, that she would clap her hands over her ears and just take off running.
Mm-hmm. And as a parent, you, for me at least, I always kind of get that heart pounds a little faster because I know, okay, she's going to freak out. And you're trying to think, okay, when this happens, how can I calm her down? Because there are certain times when you can't avoid every single sound. You'd like to, but realistically, you can't. There might be a car that backfires next to you, or someone might turn on a hand dryer at the bathroom and dry their hands. So it's we do what we can to avoid trigger situations, but sometimes
I guess
you
with
have
us
to deal
because
with
the noises were always unexpected noises, because I wasn't going to deliberately take her to, you know, fireworks was about the only thing you could plan ahead on.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of it was going to be completely unexpected, so it just made for frequent adrenaline rushes in me when she was a preschooler. By the time she started school, she pretty much no longer would go into the blind panic. She might clap her hands over her ears, but she wasn't going to take off running. You know, and she didn't like them and whatnot, but, you know, she did outgrow the need to run away from it, I guess you might say. So, yeah, it does.
It gets better.
Yeah.
I've noticed
yeah.
that, too, with our oldest daughter, is that what used to completely send her into that blind panic even a year ago, she can tolerate now. So I think it's just she's getting older. She's getting a little more handle and control on her senses and sensory issues. And she's used to dealing and having coping techniques. So as she gets older, it's getting easier.
You know, as the kids age, because my daughter developed diabetes as a teenager, and, you know, the first few years she was in and out of the hospital all the time, and when she would have what's called a DKA episode, when they've had too many high blood sugars and they develop ketone acidosis, their cognitive functions are not right, you know, and there's a number of things going on, but logical thinking does not occur to them. They can hallucinate. They can do all sorts of things. And in her case, you know, she became what I called my exorcist child. She would, you know, she has blonde hair and green eyes, and her eyes would get red-rimmed, which would look particularly creepy. And she became really foul-mouthed and belligerent, which wasn't the normal teenager I knew. This was a new creation, you know, and like I said, the exorcist child. And you'd have her in the hospital, and she'd be cursing out the nurses and telling them all sorts of wacky stuff. And I kept telling her, you know, quit doing that. If you want to yell at them and call them names, wait until after they put the IV in. You know, literally. Because, you know, they would hurt her when they would put it in because she's being really nasty. And I expected any minute now when she's doing this, she's going to spit out green pea soup.
Well,
she got older.
And
yeah, I honestly did expect any of those things to happen any time now, because this was like a demonically possessed child when she was like this. A few hours from now, after they started the treatment, she would start behaving normally, more and more of herself. The cognitive functions would take the longest to return to full ability. But as she got older and approached 20 and then passed it, those exorcist moments disappeared, thank goodness. You know, now she lives an hour away, and there have been a few occasions she's called and said, I need you to come down here. I'm sick, and I think I'm going to have to go to the hospital. And so I would go to her house. Could she have done that at 18 or 19? No. She never saw herself as being sick. Even when she was getting really, really bad and hallucinating, you know, it took a long time before she recognized, I'm not right, I think I need to go to the hospital. Then it took even longer for her to develop the ability to at least control some of the aggressive and belligerent behaviors that she would also get with the DKA episode, which isn't uncommon. You know, if you've never dealt with it with someone that is a diabetic and has one of those, their entire personality changes, right, entirely. And they do become really odd acting. I guess the closest I've ever been able to tell anybody, there's a scene in Steel Magnolias that shows the character played by Julia Roberts, it has diabetes, it shows her having an issue. I think in her case it was low blood sugar. But they do change how they behave, and they can act really oddly. And, you know, it's caused by a physical thing, the same as many other behavior issues. And sometimes we do get better control as we learn to deal with it longer. And maturity.
Yeah, I think so, too. That sounds, I remember the scene you're talking about in Steel Magnolias, so it sounds like it's much, much worse with your daughter. But that's good that she can also recognize and deal with it before it becomes
right. You know, now it's unusual for her to have to go to the hospital now, but for her, even going to the hospital can be risky because of the fact that there's two different kinds of diabetes, and they're essentially different diseases. And the most common one is not the one she's got. The most common one is type 2. And she has an autoimmune version, which is type 1. And even doctors often don't recognize the difference between the diseases and will do strange things, like take away her insulin. And in her case, her body does not produce any insulin ever and never will again. And she has to have this what's called long-term insulin in order to keep her blood sugars from rising. And the last time she was in the hospital, they didn't want her to have it anymore. And so there was quite a to-do and whatnot over that, which resulted in her another high blood sugar before she was released. So, you know, just because you're seeing a doctor doesn't necessarily mean that this is a doctor that has a good grasp of the issue that you may be experiencing. And I'm sure you deal with it with the autism, too.
Yeah, I mean, we have a family doctor that's, at this point, I just say, oh, they go to her once a year to get their, you know, physicals and their shots, and that's the only time we take them there. And if they need anything related to autism or special needs at all, they go to our local children's hospital. They have what's called the child development unit there, where that's all they do is deal with developmental issues and diagnosis. And they have developmental pediatricians that are wonderful. They can just like look at them, and I know the developmental pediatrician they see 5 minutes in her company, she spotted everything that our general doctor missed for years, just in you know, watching them for a short time. So feel more comfortable with the developmental pediatrician, because that's what they focus on. And general doctor is good enough for shots and physicals.
Right, right. And I can see that too, you know, that makes sense. That's their specialty. That's part of the reason that anyone would go see someone that is a specialist of some sort, is to deal with their particular issues. Just like my daughter has someone she goes and sees regularly to deal with hers, and then everything's good and fine, as the saying goes. It's only when you had to deal with someone else that there would be an issue going on. You know, we're now winding down to the last few minutes of the program. You want to tell everybody the titles of your books again?
Sure. currently available are Chasing Byron. It's a historical fiction about a small-town girl who meets the poet Lord Byron, and she wants to she's hoping to have an exciting life and run off to London and leave her small town. And that doesn't quite work out how she has planned in her head. That's through Highland Press. And also available is 90 Cats and No Litter Box in Sight. That's published through Utopia Press. And it's a romantic comedy about a girl named Glynis who is looking for Mr. Right, but in all the wrong places, and overlooks that the best guy for her has been there the whole time. And what's coming out later this year is a reprint of historical fiction about John Keats and Fanny Brawn called Heart's Affection. And that should be out sometime this year through Highland Press. And then in the works, I have a bunch of different things. I write across the genres, but currently out are historical fiction and romantic comedies. So if you like history or if you like current stuff, there's a little bit for everybody. And
it
I really like putting humor into my stories. I always have to have the comic relief, even if it's supposed to be a serious book. There's got to be someone that's the comic relief. I don't think I could ever write anything that's very straight, dramatic, or I always need that little bit of lightness and humor to it.
Well, I was told once that comedy is the grease over speed bumps of life. So, yeah, it does kind of work that way, doesn't it?
And that's a good way to put it. And I think it's harder to write probably than drama, something very serious. I think comedy is a little bit harder to write because what you think is funny, someone else might not think is funny. So you have to try to reach a wide audience.
I think probably the most boring thing that there would have to be to write or read would be a toss-up between a technical manual and a geological report. I used to actually use geological reports to cure insomnia because they are really, really dry.
Yeah. My husband's a mathematician, and if I couldn't sleep, I'd be like, tell me about your research. And he would talk about his research till I fell asleep.
Ah.
That works too.
Yeah, I suspect what me sitting here, and I'm almost mathematically illiterate. Yeah, and I'm trying to think of research in the math. Okay, to be honest, for me, that's kind of beyond my ability to even begin to understand. So I won't pretend to. I was one of those people that passed algebra class by the skin of my teeth. So yeah, I'm not exactly up to par on a lot of mathematical things. And your website one more time.
It's Molly Zenk, MollyZenk. .webs.com.
Okay. Well, folks, with that, we have run out of time. I hope that tonight's program has given everyone a little bit of entertainment, as well as plenty of food for thought and more illumination for your personal journey towards truth. Tune in again next time as we bring another guest, another topic, and a whole new idea for your consideration. We will be having another author on as we start our author series. So tonight, you've been listening to The Dawn of Shades, and I'm your host, Gia Scott, and good night.
you're the one.